Well, they've kept their word, Sir Rizal Garvai, the Earl of Anvil Rock, said, looking down at the dispatch. The semaphore stations had flashed word of the Carisians' arrival ahead as soon as the first picket boat reached the shore.
It looks like they've kept their word, Sir Taril Lecter, the Earl of Tartarian, corrected in a finicky sort of tone, and Anvil Rock gave him a glare.
I don't really think they're very likely to go back on it after this. He waved the dispatch at his friend. That would be just a teeny bit stupid of them, don't you think?
Of course it would. And of course I don't think they're going to. I'm simply saying that until we have Iris and Divan back on Coruscantian soil in one piece, I'm keeping my guard up.
Tartarian grimaced.
For that matter, you know damned well as I do, that there are people right here in Manchir who'd prefer to see Divan dead at Wharfside rather than seated on a throne as a Carisian puppet. And not all of them would be acting without the Church's blessings, or instructions, for that matter.
You're right. Anvil Rock dropped the dispatch on the table and strode to the window. The chamber in which they stood was in one of the palace's taller towers, looking out over the harbor and Manchir Bay beyond. It was a spectacular view in the mid-morning sunlight, despite, or perhaps because of, the scores of windmills which crowned so many of Manchir's buildings, spinning briskly or slowly, depending upon their size and power, and gilding the city with their own liveliness and flickering motion. Yet the harbor itself looked strangely empty at the moment, despite the miles of orange and white bunting and banners hoisted to dance with the wind from every spire, rooftop, and waterfront crane, because every small vessel which would normally have dotted its waters was absent. The Earl knew where they were, and he took the time for a brief, heartfelt prayer that none of them belonged to another of Jaspar Clinton's Rakurai, who'd managed to smuggle a few tons of gunpowder aboard.
You're right, he sighed again. But the Carisians have made it abundantly clear that they're transporting and treating Divan and Iris with all of the respect they deserve. And if that dispatch is right, if they are flying the heir's banner, then they're officially underscoring their recognition of him as the rightful Prince of Coruscant. That's pretty conclusive evidence that they have no intention of backing off from the terms Phillips reported he and Iris accepted.
And you think members of the Royal Council aren't going to argue that a 19-year-old girl had no business accepting any sort of terms in her brother's name?
Tartarian's tone was skeptical, almost scornful.
Shan Wei, Rizal. There are members of the Regency Council, far less the entire Royal Council, who feel that way, and that doesn't even get us to Parliament or the Temple Loyalists. For someone as smart as we both know Charlian Armark is, she's hanging an awful lot of faith on our ability to convince the entire damned princedom to ratify a teenager's decisions of state, especially one like this one.
If you think they were bad terms, you should have said so at the time, Anvil Rock pointed out, turning his head to glare over his shoulder once more.
If I'd thought they were bad terms, I would have said so at the time. I happen to think they're the best terms we could possibly have hoped for. I'm just pointing out that whether or not the Carisians have any intention of backing off, we're going to find Coruscantians who think we ought to. And some of them, I might mention the late, unlamented Earl of Craggy Hill as an example, may not be shy about trying to do something about that.
Well, we'll just have to see about that, won't we? Anvil Rock's expression was grim, his eyes hard as Barkor Mountain granite. But I've got quite a bit of faith in Corin and Charles, and even young Windshare. For that matter, people like Craggy Hill are why we have executioners. And personally, Taril, I think we've had just about enough of that kind of crap over the last 2 or 3 years, don't you?
The cheers rolled up from the waterfront as the oared tugs eased Destiny against the wharf's thick fenders. They crested and swelled in waves, washing over the galleon and the crowd of dignitaries waiting to greet her like a tempest. Guns rumbled like that tempest's smoky thunder as the fortresses and every warship in the harbor sent up the rolling 18-gun salutes due the long-absent heir to Coruscant's throne, and her topmen manned her yards while her marines snapped to attention and presented arms to her royal passengers. The cheers redoubled as the gangplank ran up to the galleon's side, and the crowd pressing against the cordon of Coruscantian troops, there wasn't a single Corycian soldier or marine in all that raucous shoreside tumult, waved hands, flags, and scarves, while others threw clouds of flower petals into the air. The petals swirled like particolored snow in a city which had never seen snow in its life, and Hector Aplin Armach knew the trumpeters behind the dignitaries were blowing a fanfare only because he could see the raised instruments. No one more than a few feet from the musicians could have hoped to actually hear them in all that wild, unbridled bedlam. He stood on Destiny's quarterdeck, hands clenched behind him, and watched that crowded wharf through narrow eyes. He was very young for his rank and duties. Indeed, he'd celebrated his 17th birthday on the same day Prince Divan had celebrated his 11th, since there were only 6 days between their actual birth dates, and Divan had insisted that they share. But he'd seen and done a great deal in those 17 years, and been tutored in the duty expected of a naval officer by the finest captain he'd ever known. More, he'd become a son of the House of Armagh. He'd seen the working of politics and policy at the highest level from inside the imperial family, and so he knew why the foreign, common-born duke who'd been betrothed to their princess couldn't possibly be by her side when she and her brother, the rightful Prince of Coruscant, returned to their homeland at last. He'd understood how it would be, how it had to be, but he hadn't had a clue how hard it would be, and his hands gripped even tighter as he thought about how easily a temple loyalist fanatic could use that mad confusion to get a pistol close enough to kill the young woman he'd come, against all odds, to love. It had happened to his stepmother, after all, right here in this same princedom, despite the presence of Sajin Merlin, and under far less chaotic conditions, and yet there was nothing he could do about it except to trust Corin Garvey to get it right. He was Iris and Divan's cousin, and everything Caleb or Charlian or Merlin Athrawas had ever said indicated that he and his father were both men of honor, and that Corin was very, very good at his job. If anyone could keep Iris safe, Garvey was that anyone, but it was hard, hard, to trust a man he'd never met with the most vital task in his universe. Iris and Divan walked between the lines of Destiny's Marines and started down the gangplank, Earl Corus at their backs, and his heart swelled with pride as he watched them. Divan was obviously nervous, but he held his head high, and if he simultaneously clutched his sister's hand, who should blame him? Certainly his subjects didn't, for the impossible volume roared still higher as they saw the royal brother and sister. As for Iris, if there was an anxious bone in her body, no one could have guessed it from her graceful, regal carriage. They gained the wharf, and the men gathered to greet them stepped forward, and Hector's proud eyes narrowed as he saw the orange-trimmed white cassock and priest's cap. The crowd roar diminished suddenly, magically, as the man in that cassock raised one hand. It didn't die away completely, but it faded until a single voice could be heard, and Clermont Gerling, Archbishop of Coruscant, spoke.
"Let us pray, my children."
The crowd noise faded still further, dropping away into a quiet in which the snapping of flags and bunting and the cries of seabirds and sea wyverns, disturbed by all the uproar, could be heard echoing down from above.
"O most mighty and magnificent God,"
Gerling prayed into that stillness, his voice carrying firm and strong,
"we thank you from the bottoms of our hearts for the grace which you have vouchsafed us this day in the return of these, our beloved Prince Divan and his sister Princess Iris. We thank and praise you for the way in which you have spread your protecting arm about them, keeping them safe during their long absence, warding them from harm, preserving them from danger. We glorify you for moving so powerfully and mysteriously in the hearts of men and women of goodwill as to bring this moment to pass. We beseech you to remain with them, to guard and guide them, to give them wisdom that they may know and do your will. We beseech you also to so guide and move the Regency Council and our Prince's Council Royal and his Parliament assembled that we may find that peaceful resolution to the remaining points of contention between Coruscant and the Empire of Corus, which we know is near and dear to your heart, as it must also be to the hearts and minds of all good and godly men and women. Be with us in the days to come. Strengthen us when we falter. Bear us up when we stumble, and bring us in the fullness of time to that place in which you would have us be as your beloved sons and daughters. We ask this in the name of the love you proclaim to all men and women in the words and mighty deeds of your archangels so many years ago. Amen.
Absolute silence hovered for a long, aching moment, enhanced and not broken by the wash of water around wharf pilings, the sigh of wind in Destiny's rigging, and the crackling pop of that blue flag flying from her masthead, and then the stillness vanished into cheers even louder than before. The last time Iris Dakin had been in the Grand Council Chamber, her father had occupied the throne behind that long, massive table of gleaming, intricately carved wood. Now that throne sat empty, its cushioned seat occupied only by a simple presence crown, and the dozens of men who'd been seated around the table rose, bowing profoundly, as she and Divan stepped through the door, followed by Archbishop Claremont and Sir Philip Osgood, Earl of Corus.
His Highness Prince Divan, the door warden announced loudly and unnecessarily. His Eminence Archbishop Claremont, Her Highness Princess Iris, the Earl of Corus.
The sound of Iris's heels on the brilliantly polished marble floor was crisp and clear in the silence that followed. She walked beside Divan, her hand laid upon his left arm, and her brother's eyes were very bright. Despite his youth, his head was high, his deportment was that of a gentleman escorting a high-born lady, with the poise and assurance of someone twice his age, and she saw one or two eyebrows rising among the noblemen waiting for them.
"You show them, Divan,"
she thought proudly, from behind the calm composure of her own expression.
"You remember everything we talked about, and you show them."
They advanced to exactly the proper spot on the chamber floor, and the Earl of Anvilrock stepped around the council table. He crossed the black and white squares of marble that glistened in the sunlight pouring down from the high windows set into the chamber's roof, and once again went to one knee before them, bending his head.
"Your Highness," he told Divan, "in the name of your Regency Council, of the Council Royal, of your Parliament, and all of the subjects of your realm, I welcome you home. Each and all of us have prayed long and hard that we might see this day, and I know I speak for your entire council when I tell you how deeply my heart rejoices that God and the archangels have permitted you to return to us safely at last."
"I thank you, my Lord Earl."
Divan's young voice was clear and admirably grave as he repeated the formal response in which Iris and Corus had drilled him.
"The reports of the manner in which you have governed and protected my people and my princedom in my stead and as my regent during my absence have gladdened my heart. And,"
he looked directly into Anvilrock's eyes as the Earl raised his head,
"I'm very happy to see you again, cousin."
His voice changed subtly with the last sentence, becoming both younger and far less rehearsed. And Anvilrock had to swallow hard as he looked into those brown young eyes and saw the truth behind them.
"Thank you, Your Highness," he said, and turned his attention to Iris. "We are all equally gladdened and grateful to see you return safely to us as well, Your Highness."
"Thank you, my lord."
Iris heard the tiniest waver in her own voice. It surprised her, and she blinked hard, then reached out to Anvilrock. He took her hand and kissed it,
then rose without releasing it, and extended his other hand to Divan. "Your places await you," he said. Iris was a little surprised. Divan had been escorted to that empty throne and seated in the smaller, comfortably upholstered chair on the uppermost step of the dais on which it sat. They'd had to put two more cushions in it to make him tall enough, then place a stool so his feet didn't dangle. But she'd expected that. Until he was crowned as Prince of Coruscant, he could not be seated in the throne itself, although the position of his chair underscored his right to claim that throne. What surprised her was that she was seated beside him, at his right hand, in the position which would have been granted to Divan's consort, had he been old enough to wed. And the reason that surprised her was that she was merely the rightful prince's sister, and one who hadn't yet quite attained her own age of majority to boot. By law, she had no more standing in the royal council than she did in the succession. Seating her at Divan's right granted her that standing at least temporarily, and she wondered whether it had been Anvilroch's idea or Tartarian's. Before her exile to Delphirach, she would have wagered that it was Tartarian's. Now, having read the correspondence between Corus and Anvilroch, and between Anvilroch and Caleb and Charlion, she was less certain of that. Her cousin had neither sought nor wanted the responsibility which had fallen upon him, and he would have been the first to argue that he was thoroughly unqualified for it. Yet he discharged his duties well, and along the way he'd become far more adroit at treading the mazes of power and shaping those mazes when necessary than either of them had ever expected he might.
"Would you honor us by opening our deliberations in prayer, Your Eminence?"
Anvilroch requested, and Clermont Gerling rose from his place at the table directly to Divan and Iris's right, as befitted God's direct representative.
"Of course, my lord,"
the dark-haired, dark-eyed archbishop replied. He stood, raising his hands in benediction, and bowed his head.
"O God, we pray you to look down upon this council as it meets to grapple with the many and weighty decisions which await it and all the people of this realm. We ask you to grant it the wisdom to make those decisions aright, to walk in your light, and to do those things which you would have us do. And we ask you especially to bless Prince Divan and his sister and guardian, Princess Iris, that they may shoulder the responsibilities you have placed upon them and lead the people of their realm in justice, safety, and well-being, to bear your sword under the banner of your champions against those enemies of your word and will who have turned even your church into a house of corruption, your temple into a den of thieves, and your inquisition into a pestilence loosed upon the world. Amen."
He never raised his voice. The sonorous words came calm and measured, without any fiery denunciatory passion, but firmly and unhesitatingly, and all the weightier for it. They were the words of a priest who knew his own mind, and God's, and Iris's eyes went wide in astonishment. The sound of a falling pin would have been deafening as the archbishop calmly seated himself once more. The rustle of his cassock, the whisper of his slippers on the marble floor, were clearly audible in the Grand Council Chamber's petrified stillness, and she managed, somehow, not to look over her shoulder to see Philip Osgood's expression.
"My God," she thought, "I never expected to hear that out of him."
No one could possibly have quibbled with the first half of the archbishop's prayer, but the second half. In just two sentences, Clermont Gerling had made the position of the church in Coruscant crystal, one might almost have said blindingly, clear. And in the process, he'd overturned centuries of Coruscantian precedent with all the subtlety of a sledgehammer and a chisel, or perhaps a charge of gunpowder. She drew a deep breath, forcing her brain to work once again. Another archbishop could have gone on 10 times as long and said nothing, but Gerling had clearly picked that brief prayer's words with deadly forethought. First, he'd referred to Iris as Divan's
sister and guardian, and that gave the church's formal imprimatur to Charlian Armok's suggestion that Iris should be formally named her brother's guardian and seated on the Regency Council. Second, he'd asked God's blessing on her and Divan as they led the people of their realm, a clear indication that he, as God's vicar in Coruscant, expected Iris to be directly involved in the governance of the princedom. That she had an acknowledged, official standing in Coruscant's power and political structures. And third, and most devastating of all, he'd endorsed Coruscant's active engagement in the war against the Group of Four in God's own name, and with all the authority of his office. As she looked around that chamber, saw the expressions of the men seated around that table, she also saw the impact of Archbishop Clermont's brief, shattering benediction echoing through the minds of the gathered counselors. And if the men behind some of those expressions clearly didn't care for what they'd just heard, that was hardly surprising. Some wouldn't care for it because of personal ambition, because they'd hoped to shape and drive Divan's policies to benefit themselves and their families. That, after all, was the one reason men acquired power in the first place, and her father had always told her that anyone who expected human beings to think differently had no business on a prince's throne, for his blindness could lead only to ruin. Others wouldn't care for it because they'd already heard Carus's terms, and knew the archbishop had heard them as well. Because in his final sentence, they heard Gerling's endorsement of the princedom of Coruscant's inclusion in the Empire of Carus. They resented the thought of Coruscant's being subordinated to any other power, the thought of bending the knee to a foreign empire which had conquered them by raw military force. Indeed, some of those counselors undoubtedly continued to hold Caleb Armok responsible for her father's death, no matter what anyone else might say. But somewhat to her surprise, the men who were so clearly angered by Gerling's endorsement of those terms appeared to be a distinct minority. She'd hoped for that, prayed it might be so, but she'd never dared to plan upon it, just as she'd never dared even for a moment to think that the archbishop might so unambiguously and unhesitatingly declare in favor of the church and empire of Carus. She'd realized in Telesburg the extent to which Michael Stainer had moved to withdraw the Church of Carus from secular power and direct day-to-day involvement in the government of the Empire. She'd been surprised by that, at least until she'd come to know Stainer, but she also knew the process was only beginning, even in old Carus and Chisholm. Here in Coruscant it had scarcely even started, and that meant the archbishop had just put all the avalanche weight of Mother Church's centuries of authority behind the acceptance of Carus's terms. All of Carus's terms, including the war against the Group of Four and the Grand Vicar himself. All in no more than four brief sentences. "I thank you, Your Eminence," Anvil Rock said at last, and it was obvious from his tone that however much he might agree with Gerling, he'd been as astonished as anyone else. Whatever else might be true, there'd been no pre-planned coordination between him and the archbishop.
"I thank you for your blessing, your words, and—"
The earl allowed his eyes to sweep the chamber, meeting those of every other person in it one by one.
"Your thoughts." "With God's grace, I believe this council and this princedom will accomplish all of the tasks to which, as you so rightly say, we've been called in his name."
Chapter 11. Thesmar, the South March Lands, Republic of Sidermark. It had taken 2 5-days just to get the guns and troops into position, Sir Reynos Alvarez thought bitterly. Left to his own devices, he could have done it in less than one. But he hadn't been left to his own devices. The formal instructions he'd been certain were on the way had arrived. They'd come from Gorath over Duke Salthar's signature, but he knew they'd actually been written in Zion.
He wondered if they'd been delivered to King Ronald, officially at least, by Vicar Zomsin's office or by the Inquisition, not that it mattered, and not that he, as a dutiful son of Mother Church, could contest them, however badly he might want to. Worse, he couldn't even argue with the underlying reasoning, since history offered all too many examples of the disastrous consequences of attempting to command an allied army by committee. No, command must speak with a single voice, and it would have flown in the face of logic, and given all manner of offense, to place the commander of the smaller component of that army in command of the entire force. Especially when that commander was a mere knight, whoever he might be related to, and the commander of the larger component was a duke. Yet the mere fact that they were inevitable, logical, and the decision of God's own church made it no less maddening to be subordinated to a Desnarian. The Empire had always looked down its collective nose at Dolar, that feckless little pocket-sized excuse for a kingdom.
"Why, it's scarcely more than an overgrown barony, you know."
And Dolarans had heaped scorn on Desnaire's miserable showing against the Republic with retaliatory delight for the better part of 200 years. The Empire's contempt for Dolar's obvious desire to ape the mercantilism of Karras had been met by Dolar's disdain for a realm so backward it continued to practice outright slavery, and the ostentatious lifestyles Desnaire's gold mines had bestowed upon its indolent aristocracy evoked as much envy as resentment among Dolar's less affluent nobility. All of that was true, and more than bad enough, yet to be subordinated to a man who was not merely a Desnarian, but might, on a good day, be able to find his arse as long as he got to use both hands, and someone else helped, made it still worse. "Be fair, Renos," he told himself, forcing his expression to remain merely thoughtful as the artillery creaked past him. "You fucked up by the numbers yourself at Alexburg. Harless probably isn't any more overconfident now than you were then. Well, not a lot more overconfident, anyway. You'd at least bothered to read Richter's reports, and I'm none too sure Harless can read, given how eager he is to grapple with the apostate Carisians." He stepped on that thought hard. The truth, if he was honest, was that he'd diverted to Alexburg largely to dodge an open field battle against new model Carisian weapons, but they couldn't avoid them forever, and at least their spies reported that barely a quarter of the Thesmar garrison was made up of Carisian marines. The rest of the Carisians were mere sailors who were unlikely to relish facing trained soldiers, and the Sidermarkians were a collection of odds and sods, a skeleton of regulars fleshed out by militiamen and ragged volunteers, half of whom were sick and starving after their forced march from Alexburg. He understood why Harless might see this as a good opportunity to blood his troops against the heretics. Probably fewer than half the garrison had firearms of any sort, far less rifles, and he had an enormous numerical advantage. And while he clearly hadn't read all of the reports, he demonstrated at least limited literacy by perusing the ones describing Connor Catesworth's final assault on the Carisian redoubts on the Divin River. Alvarez knew he had, because he'd referred to it at least a dozen times in their last conference. "I have no intention of disregarding the advantage their entrenchments give them, General Alvarez," he'd said. "But Bishop Militant Connor proved that when they can't maneuver, when they're pinned in their own redoubts, with their manpower overcommitted covering all of their points of vulnerability, a massive column can overwhelm even Carisian weapons." He laid one palm on the report from Catesworth. "Moreover, the fact that they haven't been reinforced, despite their navy, indicates that they don't have any troops to send, and I intend to be in possession of that town before they do." The hand on the Bishop Militant's report had clenched into a fist. "It has been done, it can be done, and it will be done, Sir Renos. And," he'd added blandly, "it will enhearten the enemy to crush the heretic marines who dealt your advanced guard such a painful blow." Alvarez had felt his own lips tighten, and it had been difficult to keep his expression neutral.
Harless had been careful about anything he personally might have said to his allies, but Alvarez had informants of his own. He knew how Harless had expressed himself to his own senior officers, and there'd been more than one confrontation between some of his own officers and officers from the Army of Justice who'd commented on how a Dalaran army had allowed itself to be pinned down by a field force barely a quarter its own size. Reducing Thesmar and removing the threat to my supply lines is vitally important in its own right, Harless had continued, and it's almost equally important for Dolar, since it will eliminate much of the strain supplying the army of Shiloh will place on your own canals and rivers. The Duke hadn't seemed very enthused by their combined forces' new designation, Alvarez had noted. According to his informants, Harless had lobbied hard for simply absorbing Alvarez's own force into the Army of Justice. Fortunately, someone back in Garath had obviously realized how Alvarez's men and officers would have reacted to that idea, at least. "I realize there's some risk in our plan of attack," the Desnarian had said. "No one can ever predict the outcome of a battle before it's fought, or there'd be no need to fight it in the first place. And I realize my own troops have no experience against the heretic's new weapons." The last sentence had seemed a bit perfunctory to Alvarez. More than that, a failed assault would undoubtedly have an adverse effect on the army's morale. I doubt the consequences would be much greater than we'd suffer by refusing to even attempt an attack, however. If we appear too timid to try conclusions against a force we outnumber so heavily, it cannot but undermine the men's confidence in us, and ultimately in themselves. That would be bad enough, even among the men of blood and breeding. Among the common sort in the ranks, the consequences might well be even worse. And there, Alvarez had thought, you might just have a point. About your men, at least. I'd like to think mine would understand the logic in simply screening and confining the heretics in Thesmar, doing to them what they did to Richter and Trevor, even if I'm not as sure of that as I wish I were. But you haven't personally reconnoitred the heretics' position the way I have. You've read the reports, looked at sketches, laid it out on the map, but you haven't actually seen those entrenchments and those inundations. And you haven't seen all the fucking artillery in the world looking back across them at us. It might not have mattered if Harless had personally seen the muzzles of those heretic cannon. He continued to think of artillery as the massive, immobile, slow-firing monsters which had been all but useless in land battles. Indeed, he seemed to think it was a good thing the heretics had been forced to rely upon naval gunners. He'd apparently grasped the fact that his own field guns fired much more rapidly than old-style naval weapons, but he seemed not to have made the mental leap of grasping that the new model naval guns did the same thing. Or that those contemptible, common-born Carisian seamen had more experience in firing them than anyone else in the entire world. "So we'll attack as planned, as soon as our own artillery is in position," Harless had concluded, and Alvarez had nodded. "Of course, Your Grace," he'd said. It wasn't as if he'd had any choice, and perhaps Harless was right. Perhaps they could carry Thesmar, even if Alvarez was grimly certain the casualties would be far higher than the Duke believed. There was sometimes something to be said for the courage of ignorance, the confidence to attempt something older and wiser heads knew was impossible. And as the Archangel Chihiro himself had pointed out before one of the battles against the Fallen, when the cause was dire enough, you sometimes had to break however many eggs it took to make the omelet. But that conversation lay well over a 5-day in the past, and Alvarez's frustration had grown with every passing day while the heretics continued to improve their positions and the Desnarian component of the army of Shiloh struggled to get into position. It was especially maddening because Harless ought to have known, as Sir Reynos Alvarez certainly did, that the inefficiency of the Desnarian officer corps had had a great deal to do with the fashion in which the Siddharmarkian army had kicked its arse up one side and down the other over the centuries. The fact that Desnair hadn't managed to overcome those shortcomings for the Jihad was not reassuring. But what was even less reassuring was the fact that Harless's officers obviously thought they had overcome them, which said some really horrendous things about how bad the situation had been before the Imperial Army's current reorganization. The good news was that the worst problem seemed to be at what the Dolaran army would have called the divisional level. Even for Dolar, the regiment remained the primary combat formation, and divisions were purely administrative organizations. But division commanders, the most senior regimental commander in each division, were charged with coordinating the movement and supply of all the regiments in their divisions. That at least established a clear chain of command and authority and responsibility. Alvarez wasn't really certain the Desnarian army had divisions in that sense at all, and it was obvious to him that there was precious little coordination above the regimental level in the Army of Justice. The fact that Desnarian infantry regiments were half the size of Dolaran regiments only made that worse, as did the obvious contempt for the entire concept of infantry emanating from Harless's senior officers. They clearly continued to regard cavalry as the decisive arm, despite how disastrously they'd fared against Sidermarkian infantry in the past. Indeed, Alvarez had heard even Earl Hennett, the official commander of Harless's infantry, quoting the Desnarian aphorism, "Cavalry conquers, infantry occupies." Odd how poorly that had worked out against the Republic in times past. At least their better regimental commanders seemed to be figuring out just how screwed up they were, Alvarez told himself as the last battery moved past him toward its pre-selected position. Some of them even seemed willing to learn from mere Dolarans. They'd actually spent the last 5 days or so inviting his own company and regimental commanders to dine with them and then pick their brains for the Council of Experience. Even some of their artillerists had quietly discussed their trade with his. "Of course, no one's ever going to be able to teach a Desnarian cavalry commander anything about his job," he told himself bitingly, since no one in the entire world could possibly understand it as well as he does to begin with. They're all natural-born centaurs, after all. His mouth twisted at the thought, and he reminded himself, again, that his own dislike for Desnair and Desnarians might well be coloring his evaluation. On the other hand, some things genuinely were so bad that even a tendency to look on the bad side couldn't make them any worse. "We'll just have to see how it all works out," he thought, "and I can't think of a single time I've hoped I'll be proved wrong as much as I hope it this time." "The listening posts say they're moving up, my lord," Lieutenant Denton Carmichael reported. The brown-haired Marine was very tall for a Carisian, considerably taller than the Earl of Hanth, in fact, with a dour expression that caused some people to miss the quick wit behind it. Hanth, however, knew that dourness reflected the curb bit Carmichael had set to control his searing anger. He did an excellent job of containing it, truth be told, and he hadn't needed to control it before one of the cousins he'd been fostered with died in Zion with Gwilym Manthir. That was one of the reasons Hanth had chosen Carmichael as his personal aide. The lieutenant was a good man, despite the anger burning inside him, and Hanth wanted him out of the immediate line of fire until he'd had a chance to lay some of those demons. Far better to give the youngster time before he found himself leading a platoon in combat and had the opportunity to commit the sort of acts that would seal him into bitter vengefulness forever. Besides, Carmichael was a very good aide.
"They're moving up where we expected them?"
"Yes, my lord. The listening posts say they can't actually see very much, but from the sounds they're deploying their guns on Sullivan Hill, midway between the Navy Redoubt and Redoubt Number 1. The lieutenant grimaced, right where they thought we wouldn't realize they'd been digging gun pits.
Now, Dinton, at least they tried to fool us."
"Yes, my lord, and they probably would have if we'd been deaf and blind." Lieutenant Carmichael, the Earl observed, seemed disinclined to give the army outside Thesmar the benefit of the doubt. For that matter, Hanth wasn't prepared to give them the benefit of much doubt, but as he'd said, the Desnarians and Dolarans had at least tried. Their fatigue parties had waited until full dark every night,
then moved up as quietly as possible to just behind their front line and gone to work on the gun pits. They'd stopped work well before dawn and done their best to conceal the growing line of emplacements behind loads of cut greenery.
They got that one from Tyson, he thought grimly, which at least shows they aren't too proud to learn from someone else. Unfortunately for them, it doesn't work anywhere near as well against someone who can look directly down on it from above.
The Sullivan Hill lookout tower had spotted the enemy's efforts the very first night and carefully plotted them on the engineer's maps. Because a 12-pounder smoothbore's maximum range was no more than 1,600 yards with solid shot, about 1,300 for shells, the enemy gun line had to be within 1,200 yards or so of the entrenchments if it hoped to suppress Hanth's own artillery. They were actually a bit closer than that, and some of the guns they'd brought up close behind their front and hidden behind local terrain obstacles were interesting. They hadn't managed to conceal them anywhere near as well as they clearly thought they had, and Hanth had climbed to the lookout tower to examine them himself through his double glass. They had shorter, stubbier barrels, like undersized carronades, and he'd come to the conclusion that they were probably the Dalaran angle guns the spies had reported.
I could have gone all year without those turning up, he thought now, looking back down at his maps while he considered Carmichael's report.
He had no reports on their maximum range. They certainly shouldn't be able to match the range of his rifled naval angle guns, but it was entirely possible they could throw shells farther than their regular field guns, given the angles to which they could probably elevate. He doubted it could be much over 2,000 or 3,000 yards, given their barrel length, the fact that they were smooth bores, and the apparent size of their shells, but he didn't like the thought of shrapnel raining down on his own gunners. He'd known of their existence before anyone ever spotted them here at Thesmar, so he'd taken precautions by roofing his riflemen's firing positions with timbers and a 2-foot layer of dirt for overhead protection, but he was still in the process of extending that protection to his artillerists. He'd concentrated on the farthest forward batteries, especially here on the Allies' left, where the enemy's preparations were most evident. The work remained far from complete for the batteries in the center and on his right, however, and they couldn't provide overhead cover to his own angle gunners. They had to be out in the open to work their high-trajectory weapons.
We may be going to lose some of them, he admitted to himself, but not as many as those bastards on the other side are going to lose. All right, Dinton, he said calmly. I assume Major Jadwale's men have been stood to?
Yes, sir. His battalion's on full alert. And Commander Parkes moved up to the Navy redoubt,
Carmichael added with a careful lack of expression.
Well, I'm sure that's filled Lieutenant Buchanan with joy, Hanth observed dryly. Still, he'll manage to survive, I think. As you say, my lord.
Hanth shook his head without ever looking up from the map. Lieutenant Simon Buchanan was officially HMS Trumpeter's third lieutenant. Unfortunately, Admiral Hywitt had completely disarmed Trumpeter, distributed her guns to the Thesmar defenses, and turned the galleon herself into a hospital ship. The Navy redoubt, just behind the first line of earthworks, was armed with 6 of her 30-pounders, 4 of her 57-pounder carronades, and 2 rifled 6-inch angle guns. Hanth didn't like having the angle guns that far forward, since there was no way to withdraw such massive pieces if the enemy managed to break through, but they gave him several miles' reach into the Temple Boys' position. He hadn't used them yet, plenty of time for that after the other side had moved sufficiently juicy targets into their range, and he had no intention of using them tonight either, although Commander Arthur Parker had full authority to bring them into action if he decided it was necessary. That was undoubtedly why Parker had taken himself off to the Navy redoubt, although Buchanan probably wouldn't see it that way. He was a rather thorny young man, with an irascible personality, but those flaws were accompanied by an extraordinary amount of energy and a painstaking attention to the details of his job.
I imagine Arthur will keep a light hand on the bridle, assuming one's necessary. Of course, I'd prefer for my artillery commander to not get his silly ass killed the very first night, too. I think it's probably time we moved outside, Dinton, he observed in a resigned tone.
He really wasn't looking forward to the climb up to the lookout tower in the middle of the night. He wasn't getting any younger. But at least if they got an early enough start, he could stop to catch his breath every 50 feet or so.
Yes, my lord.
If Lieutenant Carmichael felt any amusement at his decrepit commanding officer's resignation, he was wise enough to keep it to himself. Colonel Alfred McIntyre squinted up at the sky. The night was blacker than Shanwei's riding boots, and he was happy it was so, despite the fact that he was standing in the midst of well over 24 artillery pieces which were being loaded in complete darkness. His gunners were sufficiently well-trained to assuage any worries he might have felt on that score, and the moon would be rising within the hour. Not that it would be much help. They were just past the new moon, and the waxing crescent was little more than a nail paring. The angle guns had been provided with incendiary rounds, which should do a decent job of illuminating the target, but neither he nor any of his gunners had any desire to be carrying lanterns around with all those powder cartridges just waiting to explode. McIntyre grimaced at the thought, but it was secondary. The timing was more important, and Sir Reynos would not be pleased if they got it wrong. The colonel and Sir Reynos didn't much like each other. McIntyre had been transferred from the Navy to teach Alvarez's artillerist their trade. Before that, he'd been Captain McIntyre, and a firm supporter of Earl Thirsk's effort to reform the Navy. Given Alvarez's attitude toward Thirsk, that had created a certain inevitable tension between them. Fortunately, even though Alvarez was just as bigoted where Thirsk was concerned as McIntyre had expected him to be, he'd also realized how badly he needed someone with McIntyre's expertise. That had kept him civil long enough for both of them to recognize that they had a job to do, and while they were never going to like one another, they'd settle down into a decent working relationship.
And as long as I don't find some way to screw up, it'll probably stay that way.
Probably. At least Alvarez was no more enthusiastic about this particular exercise in Desnarian stupidity than McIntyre was, so he was unlikely to hold its inevitable outcome against his own artillery commander. Whoever got the blame, however, a lot of men were about to get killed, and far too few of them would be heretics.
"Now that's a thought you'd best keep to yourself, Alfred, my boy. I believe it's called defeatism, and I suspect Father Sullivan would have a little something to say about it."
No doubt the Schulerite would, and McIntyre intended to do everything he could to make the assault succeed. And counting the guns in his own and the Desnarian battery to his right, between him and the bay, they had 4 times the artillery they'd observed on the heretic side, in this particular area of their fortifications at any rate. But unlike the Desnarians, he knew what new model artillery could do, and the guns in those entrenchments were even better protected now than they'd been 2 5-days ago. He didn't know if the heretics realized the Royal Dalaran Army had its own angle guns, but they'd been steadily improving their position's overhead protection, and the Army of Shiloh's delays had given them entirely too much time in which to work. Worse, all of the Army of Shiloh's guns were lighter than anything on the heretic side, and at least some of the Desnarian gunners seemed to think that was a good thing.
Idiots! I'll guarantee they don't have a clue what Carisian gunners can do.
Alfred McIntyre did. He'd been a first lieutenant aboard one of the Dalaran galleons Admiral Gwilym Monthyr had pounded into wreckage before his own ships had been forced to strike at the Battle of the Narrows. Obviously, no one in the Desnarian army had bothered to discuss the implications of that little affair with someone from the Desnarian Navy. While it was true that 12-pounders fired rather more rapidly than 30-pounders, the difference was far lower than the Imperial gunners seemed to be assuming. For that matter, no gun could maintain its maximum rate of fire forever. In fact, once the tubes heated and forced the gunners to slow down, the advantage, if there was one at all at that point, shifted to the 30-pounder. And he rather doubted that any Desnarian, even in their navy, had any concept of what a charge of canister from a 30-pounder was like.
Well,
They won't be able to say that this time tomorrow, will they? Those who are still alive, at any rate. Somehow, despite his personal dislike for Desnarians, that thought gave him very little satisfaction.
"Stand by,"
Sir Shelton Lewis, the Baron of Climehaven, said tersely. The Baron crouched in a small lean-to, open to the west, but with a solid, very solid, wall to the east. He'd made certain of that, since he had no desire for any chink of light from the bull's-eye lantern to warn the heretics what was coming. He needed that lantern to keep an eye on his watch, however, and for one of the few times since the Army of Justice had headed north, he felt a sense of profound satisfaction. Climehaven was 65 years old, and the riding accident which had crippled his right leg 30 years ago had left him with continual low-grade pain, which tended to flare up into something far more acute upon occasion, especially in cold or rainy weather, and had ended his cavalry career forever. The bitterness of his forced retirement had added an even sharper edge to a naturally crotchety personality over the ensuing decades, but while Climehaven was a tiny barony, so small it appeared only on the largest scale maps, it was also an ancient one, and the current baron was related to many of the Empire's most powerful families. He was even a connection by marriage to Duke Trakos, and he'd traded shamelessly upon those connections when Mother Church decreed the massive enlargement of the Imperial Army for service in the Jihad. All the connections in the world couldn't put him back in command of a cavalry regiment, however, and so he'd ended up as the Army of Justice's senior artillerist. Despite the fact that he'd never even seen an artillery piece 2 years ago, most of the Imperial Desnarian Army's officer corps could have made that statement, however, and he'd done his best to master his new responsibilities since. Along the way, he'd been amazed by the new model artillery's lethality, and he was looking forward to unleashing that lethality upon the heretics. And that accounted for his current satisfaction. Denied regimental command or not, the Army of Shiloh was awaiting his signal. His gunners would open the attack, and he was determined they'd do it precisely on time. He watched the second hand sweep around the watch's face. No one would fault him if he was off a minute or so either way, but he wasn't going to be. Not tonight. He raised his left hand, aware of the lieutenant standing to one side, where he could see into the lean-to's illuminated interior and simultaneously be seen by the crews of the nearest guns. Climehaven never looked away from his watch. He simply waited, and as the second hand reached 13, his hand slashed down. It was certainly impressive, Howard Braegard acknowledged. He stood atop the lookout tower with Carmichael and a signalman, and the darkness to the west exploded as scores of muzzle flashes ripped the night apart. The fiery streaks of the shell's fuses burned their way through the dark, and his eyes narrowed as some of those streaks rose in high arcs before they came plunging towards Earth once more. So those were angle guns. Not a surprise, but still good to know. We'll have to get the sketches circulated so everyone else knows what they look like, too. The thought moved through the back of his brain. Its front was busy watching to see how effective that hurricane of light and thunder truly was. One of the problems the enemy had created for himself by moving his guns up in darkness was that none of the gunners had been able to register their fire. They knew the entrenchment's general direction, but that wasn't the same thing as being able to aim properly, and most of the initial salvos had very little effect. Shells that actually hit the earthworks, and didn't just bounce off, were simply absorbed, and black powder was a fairly anemic explosive when it came down to it. The quantities packed into a Temple Loyalist 12-pound shell, especially one with most of its internal volume taken up by shrapnel balls, did minimal damage to the solidity of an earthen berm 20 feet deep at its base. Only a minority of them did hit the entrenchments, however. The majority landed short, and while some of the short rounds managed to ricochet into the earthwork's face before they detonated, at least a third of the rounds fired went high instead.
Most of the overs whistled well beyond the waiting Allied infantry and artillery, and only a handful exploded in midair at a point which might actually have thrown shrapnel into the defenders. Hanth doubted that came as a total surprise to the enemy gunners, and it certainly wasn't a surprise to him or Commander Parker. While he was pretty sure the Army of Shiloh had expected the sudden, completely unanticipated eruption of artillery to have a severely demoralizing effect on its enemies, it probably hadn't hoped to inflict much actual damage with its first few salvos. What it had achieved, however, was to put at least a dozen incendiary rounds behind the Allies' parapet. Packed with saltpeter, sulfur, and meal powder, they gushed light and flame through the holes bored through the shell walls for that very purpose as they bounced and rolled. Fortunately, most of them landed in the empty space between the first and second lines of entrenchment, with nothing much to set on fire, but they accomplished their primary purpose. Baron Climehaven leaned heavily on his cane, watching as the heretic's parapets were suddenly etched against the Shanwei glow and smoke of his incendiary shells. He was breathing hard, his heart racing with the exertion of dragging his bad leg to his present position, but it was worth it when he heard the nearest gun captains shouting to their crews.
"They can see what they're shooting at now, by Chihiro," he thought exultantly. "Now lay it to the bastards."
"Open fire!"
Lieutenant Simon Buchanan barked as the first enemy rounds thudded to the ground around and behind the heavily dug-in battery of the Navy redoubt. There'd been some argument over exactly what to call that battery. Originally, it had been simply labeled Redoubt Number 2 on the engineer's plat, but Buchanan had been unwilling to settle for that. He'd wanted to christen it the Trumpeter Redoubt, given where its guns and commander came from. Unfortunately, that name had been pinched by that insufferable sprout Darren Saunderson, HMS Trumpeter's fourth lieutenant, before Buchanan got his bid in, and Earl Hanth had decided it was a case of first come, first served. So Buchanan had been forced to settle for the Navy Redoubt, although at the moment he at least had the satisfaction of knowing Saunderson's battery was over 11 miles away on the slopes of Shadowline Mountain. He might have gotten the name Buchanan wanted, but Buchanan and Lieutenant Fredrick Hillsdale in Redoubt Number 1 were going to fire the Navy's first rounds in the defense of Thesmar. And if the Navy Redoubt didn't get its first shots off before Redoubt Number 1, Simon Buchanan would know the reason why. Fortunately for Buchanan's gunners, they did. Baron Climehaven winced as the enemy fired. They were enormously quicker off the mark than anyone had expected. Clearly the heretics must have gotten some hint of what was coming, and the shells smashing back at his artillerists were far heavier than he'd anticipated. He remembered a discussion with Alfred McIntyre in which the Dalaran had suggested his Desnarian allies might be underestimating the destructiveness of naval artillery. At the time, he'd put the warning down to Dalaran timorousness. After all, the Dalarans had allowed themselves to be penned up in their defenses around Terrace by a mere handful of those fearful naval guns. Of course they'd emphasize how deadly dangerous they were. Perhaps he owed them an apology, he reflected, although he'd see himself damned and in hell before he offered one. He ducked, losing his cane and his footing, and going flat on his face as a heretic shell slammed into the ground in front of him, bounced high into the air, and then detonated. He heard the splattering impact of shrapnel balls driving into earth or flesh, and a sudden chorus of screams. Only his fall had taken him out of the path of those projectiles, and his aid had been less fortunate. He groped for his cane, found it, levered himself upright, and wondered if he'd have the opportunity to issue any apologies, whether he wanted to or not.
"Hit them! Hit the bastards!"
he shouted, stumping forward into the nearest gun emplacement on his cane. "What do you think, sir?" Sir Lincoln Latimer asked quietly. Alvarez glanced at his aide, then back at the blazing line of the army of Shiloh's artillery, and shrugged.
It's too early to say, but it's just possible Duke Harless and Baron Climehaven are in the process of changing their opinions about the ineffectiveness of those slow-firing naval guns.
The Earl of Hanth remembered a conversation with Kidrick Figuera that seemed like decades ago. He'd assured the Sidermarkian general that no one in the Royal Dalaran army was going to be able to match the skill of the Imperial Carizian navy gunners. He supposed that had been arrogant of him, but the ICN had earned its expertise the hard way. Accustomed to firing from moving decks at moving targets, it was child's play to fire from fixed platforms of heavy timbers at targets that didn't move. And that didn't even consider Karras's other advantages, like the dispart and tangent sights mounted on its pieces. The dispart sight was a simple post on the muzzle swell to allow for quick, accurate alignment of the weapon's point of aim. That alone would have been a significant advantage, but the tangent ring sight on the weapon's breech was mounted on a steel bar that was fixed perpendicular to the axis of the bore in a bronze case. The bar was graduated in yards and moved up and down in the case guides with a thumb screw to fix it in place. Raised to the proper height, it automatically adjusted elevation for range when aligned with the front sight and the target. It wasn't perfect, given the differences in ballistic performance between different lots of powder, but it was far better than anything on the other side, and it allowed all the guns in a battery to be fired at the same elevation. As Lieutenant Buchanan's battery fired now. Simon Buchanan watched the strike of his battery's first shells. They landed short, which was better than landing long, and he watched several hit the ground and skip. At least two of the ricochets exploded above the enemy gun line, where their shrapnel balls had to have inflicted casualties, but that was an unacceptably low percentage. Obviously, they'd underestimated the range to the gun pits the Temple Boys had been so sneakily building for the last 5 day or so.
Make your range 1,200! Cut your fuses for 2 seconds!
Acknowledgements came back, and he saw gun captains bending over their tangent sights, sliding the bars up, squinting to make sure the gradations were properly aligned, while the number 2 on each gun set the fuses. They worked quickly, urgently, apparently oblivious to the enemy shells slamming into their protective earthworks or whistling overhead, and he felt a rush of pride in them. Earl Hanth winced as the first Dalaran angle gun shells exploded above the Navy redoubt. They were as light as he'd hoped, but that didn't mean they weren't dangerous. Cones of shrapnel streaked down from each white and red explosion, smashing into his men's positions like leaden rain. He couldn't hear the screams from here, but he knew they were there. Simon Buchanan could hear the screams, yet there weren't many of them. Firing a 30-pounder under a protective roof was a noisy proposition. But nothing gunners trained to fire from a galleon's gun deck were unaccustomed to, and Earl Hanth's insistence on providing overhead cover, and Commander Parker's decision against manning the angle guns until they were needed, paid a handsome dividend as the shrapnel slashed downward. Looking out through the broad firing slits that served as his battery's gun ports, Buchanan saw the earth ripple in a heave of dust and dirt as shrapnel impacted all around the position. He couldn't even hear the balls that hit the overhead. One of the Temple Loyalist shells hit the ground, rolled, and skittered to a wobbling halt directly in front of the number 5 30-pounder. The shell's fuse had been cut too long, or else it had burned too slowly, but in the event, that worked for the gunners who'd fired it. Instead of detonating overhead as they'd planned, the evil thing simply sat there, rocking, spouting sparks, hissing, and then detonated like Shan Wei herself. 3 of his men went down as some of its shrapnel ripped in through the firing slit. One of the wounded was screaming, the sound high and shrill as he clawed at the bloody ruin of his face, and it was only a matter of time before the enemy 12-pounders found the range as well. That could be more dangerous than the angle guns. If the Temple boys got themselves sorted out, started throwing accurately fused shells at those firing slits in horizontal salvos, casualties were likely to soar. Assuming someone gave them the time for that, of course. Buchanan's eyes were like flint as the battery's attached corpsman pulled the casualties clear, but he never looked away from his target. The guns were reloaded and relayed, and his smile was as cold as those stony eyes.
Fire!
Colonel McIntyre staggered as the heretics found the range. There were no more than 6 shells in the salvo, but the greater height of the heretics' position atop the hill gave them a direct line of fire down into McIntyre's gun pits. It wasn't the vertically plunging fire of his own angle guns, praise Chihiro, but it was bad enough. The massive 30-pounder shells exploded no more than 20 or 30 yards short of his positions, and the spreading patterns of shrapnel arrived like Langhorne's own Rakurai. The guns had been skillfully dug in, their muzzles just clearing the low earthen walls where the spoil of the gun pits had been thrown up to protect them, but the heretic's height advantage negated much of that protection. Screams went up as the shrapnel claimed its harvest of blood, torn flesh, and shattered bone, and his gun crew's faces were stone as they reloaded with desperate haste. Both the Navy Redoubt and Redoubt Number 1 were in action now. The Army of Shiloh's gunners fired as quickly as they could reload, pouring shells into the Allies' lines, but Hanth's gunners fired back much more slowly. Not because they couldn't have fired faster, but because they were shooting with cold deliberation. Protected by overhead layers of timber and earth, they returned that tornado of fire with the icy professionalism of the Imperial Carizian Navy, delivering concentrated thunderbolts to their foes. As he watched the volume of fire going back and forth, as he saw the explosions hammering the enemy's guns, Howard Braegart knew how it was going to end. The only question was how long the enemy would endure his gunner's fire before they started trying to extract their surviving artillery from the death trap they'd thrust it into. Well, Serenos Alvarez thought bitterly, so much for that brilliant inspiration. The steady flashes of the heretic guns were like coals blazing up to the steady rhythm of a blacksmith's bellows. If there was any diminution of their fire, he couldn't see it. And whatever Harless might think, they weren't firing so slowly because of their weapons' clumsiness. No, they were firing that slowly because they were taking careful aim and slaughtering the army of Shiloh's artillery. It might be a different story in open terrain, where the greater number of their lighter weapons could be brought into play against guns that weren't dug in behind walls of solid earth. But they weren't in open terrain, and matching their guns against the heretics in a duel like this one was a losing proposition. Serenos Alvarez didn't intend to lose any more of his guns, or his men, than he had to, and he turned to Captain Latimer.
Go to Colonel McIntyre. Tell him that on my authority he's to begin pulling—
His head snapped up in disbelief, and he wheeled back around as the golden voice of bugles cut through the bedlam. It was only a single bugle at first, but it was taken up by others, by dozens, and then by scores, and Serenos Alvarez swore vilely, betrayed by his own incredulity, as he recognized the call. They were sounding the charge.
Dear God,
Hanth muttered in disbelief. Visibility was so poor in the gunsmoke-smothered dark that he couldn't convince himself he'd actually seen it. Not at first. But then the lightning glare of muzzle flashes reflected from the standards at the heads of the bayonet and pike-bristling columns.
Not even a Desnarian could believe he's managed to suppress our guns. What in the name of heaven are the idiots? What in God's name do they think they're doing, my lord?
Lieutenant Carmichael had obviously seen the same thing,
and Hanth looked at his aide for a moment while his brain grappled with it. Then his nostrils flared, and he shook his head sharply.
I doubt they are thinking,
he grated, eyes straining as that vaguely seen movement was veiled by smoke and darkness once more. His jaw clenched, and he shook his head again, like a man trying to shake off a hard punch.
If there's anything remotely like an actual thought behind this, though, they have to be hoping a massive enough assault can carry the outer works by sheer weight of numbers, despite our batteries.
That's insane, my lord,
Carmichael said slowly, and there might have been an edge of horror in his voice, despite his bitter hatred for all things Dolaran.
That or the act of a man who hasn't figured out how badly the rules have changed, or maybe both.
Hanth snorted harshly, and his voice was hammered iron.
There's a term Sajin Merlin and Emperor Caleb have taken to using. A learning curve, they call it, from the charts Baron Greenvalley uses to measure units' level of training. The learning curve of whoever the hell is in command over there is about to get one hell of a lot steeper.
Wind pushed aside a wall of smoke, reflected gunfire flashed off those standards once more, and he turned to the signalman at his elbow.
Signal Captain Simpson. Enemy infantry is advancing. Illuminate in 3 minutes. At once, my lord.
The signalman turned to the bulky, swivel-mounted contraption on the lookout tower's rail. It was almost 3 feet tall and equally wide, with a lever on its side, and the signalman approached it cautiously, despite the thick glove on his left hand. The smell of heated metal rose from it, for it was searingly hot thanks to the lanterns blazing inside it, and his gloved hand gripped the steel loop handle on its side so he could peer through the ring sight at the command post at the lookout tower's base. He aligned it carefully, then began flipping the lever on its side in a practiced staccato rhythm.
Signal from Earl Hanth, sir!
Captain Lewis Simpson turned as the shout wrenched his attention from the volcano smoke and fury. He couldn't see the actual muzzle flashes from here. There were too many earthen walls in the way, but he could see their reflections lighting that smoke with flame as the guns belched thunder. Now he looked in a different direction, up at the lookout tower, a blacker shape rearing against a night-black sky. The fury of the artillery exchange picked out the latticework of its supporting spars in a lightning glare like Shan Wei's own crown. But what mattered to Lewis Simpson at that moment was the light blinking from its lofty platform. Its oil lamp flames would have been all but invisible in daylight, despite the brilliantly polished reflector and the lens which the Royal College had designed to concentrate its light, but against the night it burned with bright, fierce clarity. Daylight was the province of the heliograph or the signal flag. Darkness called for other means, and he waited as patiently as he could while the signalman read off the flashing message.
Enemy infantry is advancing, sir. Illuminate in 3 minutes.
That idiot! That Shan Wei damned witless, mother-loving, dog-fucking Desnarian piece of shit! That...
Alvarez dragged himself to a white-hot, shuddering halt. Much though Harless deserved every word, it wasn't going to do any good, or make any difference. Maybe not. But maybe if I get at least some of it out of my system now, I'll be able to face him later without cutting his throat the instant I get into range. He knew what Harless was doing, although until this moment he wouldn't have believed anyone could be stupid enough to try it. The Desnarian had realized there was no way his guns were going to silence those slow-firing, ineffective naval guns after all, so he was throwing in the infantry columns instead. The army of Shiloh's guns would be forced to stop firing when their own infantry blocked their line of fire. Until then, they'd continue to pour shells at the heretics, hoping to knock back the defensive fire. That was part of the plan Harless had discussed with his senior officers when planning this night's debacle. But the infantry wasn't supposed to be committed until after the bulk of the heretics' artillery had been silenced by his own guns. Now, like a gambler unwilling to acknowledge that Andropov's luck had turned against him,
He was casting the dice in one last grand gesture, to win or lose it all. But it was a wager which would be paid in lives, not marks, and in that moment, unwillingly, Alvarez realized what the Earl of Thirsk must have felt when Alvarez's own cousin ignored his advice off Armageddon Reef.
"At least they've got cover of darkness and all that smoke," he told himself, trying to pretend he wasn't grasping at straws. "The heretics may not even realize they're coming until our guns go silent. Even then, they won't be able to see well enough to aim. It'll be blind fire on their part, and maybe, just maybe, the infantry can get close enough to rush the parapets."
Lewis Simpson checked his watch under his command post's lantern and pulled the fire striker from its belt holster. It was an absurdly simple device which someone should have thought of years ago. Just a cylindrical steel tube about 3 inches tall and an inch in diameter, with a screw set into its bottom and a hinged, tightly fitting cap at the top. He flipped up the top with his thumb to expose the toothed steel wheel and wick. The body of the striker was filled with cotton saturated in distilled fire vine oil, which could be replenished by removing the bottom screw. Personally, Simpson would have preferred something less smoky and less poisonous, but few things in all the world were more flammable or harder to extinguish than fire vine oil, and when his thumb spun the wheel against the spring-loaded flint in a shower of sparks, the wick from the oil reservoir burst into instant flame. And smoky or not, a corner of his brain reflected, it still smells a hell of a lot better than a Shanwei's candle. His mouth quirked at the incongruity of the thought in a moment like this one, and he touched the flame to the first fuse. Sir Reynos Alvarez wondered why his teeth didn't crumble into powder under the pressure of his clenched jaw muscles as the first heretic rocket streaked into the night. The Desnarian guns had already gone silent as the three columns on the right of the assault swept past them. His own artillery would have time for no more than a single additional salvo before it had to cease fire, and he knew, somehow he knew, even before it happened, what that rocket foretold. Oh yes, he knew. And he wondered in that moment, in a strange, still corner of his brain, who he hated more, the Duke of Harless or the heretics. He watched the rocket climb, riding its own fiery breath like a curse, trailing a banner of smoke. It rose higher than he would have believed possible, and then, suddenly, it exploded. But not in the colored bursts of light he'd been warned the heretics used as battlefield signals. No. It birthed something else entirely. A single, brilliant, artificial star blazing above the army of Shiloh's advancing infantry like some bizarre midnight sun. He stared up, slitted eyes glittering in its light, and he could just make out something above it. Something that held it up, drifting on the wind like some fire-breathing wyvern come straight from Shanwei's hell. And then a second rocket streaked up to join it. And a third. The pitiless light streamed down across the infantry columns, exposing them in all their naked vulnerability, and the heretics' artillery retargeted.